This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. Happy Friday. So, with the rain from earlier this year across large parts of the state, paddocks were looking lush. And it wasn't just the livestock that benefited. Animals like kangaroos also saw a baby boom thanks to the large abundance of feed, but pastures started to dry out, as they always do, and now livestock and roos are competing for the remaining feed. A Western Queensland grazier says he's selling off stock to fee up feed because kangaroo numbers have exploded in the region. Paul Donnelly runs sheep, cattle and goats on Dunraven Station near Barcaldine. He explains what it's been like to Madeline McCosker.
Yeah, I guess with the seasons in the last 12 months or a couple of years, you know, there's been a good body of feed around the place and, you know, we're fenced, so there's been less predators inside our dog fence. But what we've noticed, you know, just since it's been getting drier in 2025 this year, the roo numbers have exploded and, you know, we're trying to get rid of a few stock that we don't need just to give less pressure on the place, but the roo numbers seem to just be exploding and we just can't hold on to the feed like we used to.
What kind of added pressure does that kind of explosion of numbers of roos mean when you are already quite dry, you know, as you said, selling off stock to be able to keep some feed?
Yeah, well, you know, like we like to let our country have a bit of a break. And, you know, if we snap any early storms or something, you know, we let their grass recover and, you know, the body of feed build back up again so, you know, we can get a good season for next year. But what we're finding this year is that the roos are just absolutely smashing any sort of green tinge or flag that comes in, and the country is just not coping. It's just not recovering, and we're finding that our country is just getting barer and barer. So it's just a bit concerning moving forward.
Would you have any kind of idea of the number of roos that you're basically running here on Dunraven?
I wouldn't have an exact number, but just driving around, there has to be either in the thousands or, you know, it could be 10,000. You know, we just don't know with exact numbers, but we're starting to sell off country just to control them so we can spell country a bit better. But, like, the roos are beating our stock to the best country because they're getting through fences and a few things, like just normal fences. So we're finding it harder and harder to spell country and let it recover when it is a drier year.
And how do you go about controlling the numbers? It's obviously, when the numbers are so large, it's not an easy thing to do and you don't always have the time, but how do you find maintaining a more manageable number?
Oh, I guess, you know, if they're stuck inside the fence, you know, and there's no predators, there's no real way of controlling them unless you can shoot them out and, you know, you can get permits, which are very hard to get from EPH, but, you know, we've got one or a number here, so we just go around and try and shoot them when we've got the time, but we're so busy with feeding and everything at present that we haven't had the time to do as much mitigation as what we'd like. You know, I do have people that come in and give me a hand from outside sources, which is great, but, you know, even then, we're time poor, and they are too, so they've got all jobs and everything too, but, yeah, the numbers just seem to be beating us at present, and, you know, it's going into dry time. You know, they're forecasting good rain, but when that eventuates is the question mark.
And if it does eventuate, then, you know, the kangaroo numbers will keep growing because it's been a good season, so it sort of seems to be like a never-ending cycle.
It is. You know, what the concerning thing is now that we've got so many numbers inside us that the roos are getting quite poor, you know, and some of them are dying. So it's a bit of an issue for us. You know, like, it's not a big issue at present, but if it doesn't rain, it could be bigger in the future. That's just it. We're just a bit worried what might eventuate out of it if it doesn't rain and we have a bad year or something. So we've got to have our eyes and ears open to everything that's going around the area and just keep an eye on what's happening out in the paddocks.
You mentioned that you have a permit, that the state government issues permits for control, and, you know, there's a limited number of kangaroos that you're allowed to cull through those permits, that the government kind of controls that based off estimates of population. Do you think, or you said it's quite difficult to get a permit, do you think that there are ways that may be more beneficial for management other than the current management options?
Listen, I'm sure it's an evolving wheel, this roo population and what's out there, but, you know, what roos are out there, I think, are very underestimated that the government have. I think there's a lot more, I mean, a lot more roos than what the government think there are, especially that they're breeding up inside these fences so quickly. You know, I know that they do aerial surveys. I don't know where they do them, but in some of this country around here, you know, we've seen huge numbers of where they are, and they keep on turning up. You know, we think that, you know, there's not many left, but suddenly here we go, another 500 or 1,000 turn up, or, you know, another 4,000 turn up. So it's a bit scary when you think that you've got not many roos left and then suddenly there's more and more and more. So, yeah, permits, you know, they are hard to get through applications, but, they, you know, there's only a certain amount of applications that are available and for certain quotas as well. So, yeah, you've just got to be lucky enough to get them.
That was by Calden grazier Paul Donnelly speaking with Madeline McCosker. Now, I had a look at the Queensland government figures for kangaroos. So they have population density and abundance estimates for 2025. So across the whole of Western Queensland, including Central, South and Northwest Queensland, Eastern Grey kangaroos were estimated to be 1,084,690 and red kangaroos 6,227,879. So if you're looking at the figures, they're broken down into zones, and zone two is the Central West, where grazier Paul Donnelly is. So in the Central West, the estimates are for Eastern Grey roos 590,888 and red kangaroos 3,710,601. Now, moving from the cattle industry to horticulture, I want to talk now about the ongoing situation with the chemical dimethoate, which this week the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority has banned the use of, essentially banned the use of in blueberries, blackberries and raspberries, because berry growers are concerned that the new rules around the use of this chemical to control fruit fly will result in a big hit to yields. But one grower, though, is still confident the industry will be able to adapt. So basically what's happened is the withholding period on the chemical from 1 day to 2 weeks has been increased from 1 day to 2 weeks for blueberries, raspberries and blackberries, but that's also under application. So it has effectively banned its use. And this was amid concerns over safe exposure limits. Amen Lel grows berries in New South Wales, where the bulk of Australian berries, blueberries, are grown. He says the move is something the industry has been expecting for several years, but he tells Lauren Bohane there will still be challenges while growers adapt.
Fruit fly is quite a damaging sort of pest. It can explode in numbers very fast. And once you've seen it in your crop, it can sort of decimate your entire crop in days. So the challenge is that dimethylate was the only chemical that was known to actually kill the maggots that are inside the fruit and actually take them out and destroy their life cycle. So it completely eradicates their life cycle, and you basically, you know, one spray was enough to basically control them. Everything else can target different stages, like the adults that are flying around and that sort of thing, but nothing really targets that maggot that's already infested in the fruit.
Right, so what will this mean for berry growers? What's that going to mean for production?
So I think initially there's going to be a big hit to yields, especially for growers who haven't already been trying the alternative methods, like the bait sprays and lure traps and that sort of thing. Many growers have already been doing that for the last 8 to 10 years and relying minimally on dimethylate anyway. So those growers are probably more likely to have a minimal impact from it. But overall, like, basically, it's a prevention strategy now. Rather than a curative strategy, growers have got to get used to the prevention side of it and making sure those traps are out there on time, making sure the bait sprays go out regularly, and just staying on top of it before the numbers explode to a point where, you know, if you let them grow to that number now, without dimethylate, you've lost the crop for the season. There's no other options.
So under these new rules, growers can apply to the APVMA to vary their registration for a 14-day withholding period before harvest. Yep. What does that mean?
Look, I think the 14 days, for most times of the year, it will basically rule out the strategy of using dimethylate and relying on that as a control strategy, because 14 days, even on blueberries in the summer, it's just too long. You're going to have overripe fruit. You're going to be losing your fruit anyway. So it does mean that growers are going to have to rely on other strategies and try to make the best of them.
Right. So, yeah, you sort of mentioned some of those other strategies there. Can you tell me what those are?
Yep. So we have a combination of lure traps. So we've got traps that target the male, where there's a pheromone in a trap, and it attracts them. They sit on it, and it's laced with a little bit of chemical and basically kills the male. So it's not actually spraying anything on the fruit. It's just a little trap that you hang in the field every 20 or 30 metres down the rows. And then there is another one that targets the females, the mature females. And then there's a bait spray, which is basically for the immature females. When they first emerge, they actually want to feed on a bit of protein before they mature and are able to reproduce. So the bait spray, it's like a protein that's laced with a little bit of chemical that you spray, you know, on non-cropping areas where you haven't got, not directly on the fruit, and actually try and target that immature female before it actually develops and kill it that way, before it becomes a problem.
Do you think that there'll be like a noticeable difference, a drop in production while the industry adapts to these new techniques, these new control methods?
I think it's definitely possible, especially in high sort of pressure years. Like, fruit fly pressure varies from one season to the next, so in a season with high pressure, the alternative strategies aren't all that successful. So I think in those years, it's quite possible that we could have a massive impact on yields. Hopefully we won't see that, but, you know, overall I'm confident that growers will learn to adapt to this. You know, we know it was on the way out. These alternative strategies are all we've got, so it'll force growers to learn how to do them and learn how to do them properly, and there may be a learning curve there where we lose some yields in the process, but in the long term I think it could be a good thing. You know, growers learning how to do it, and if we can manage fruit fly with less chemical use, then at the end of the day, I see that as a win.
You know, you were talking about that 14-day withholding period and how that sort of rules out dimethoate as an option. What impact is that going to have on berry quality?
If growers are using the alternative strategies, and as long as they can keep the fruit fly away, it won't have an impact on fruit quality. The fruit quality will still be there. It'll more be that if they get an infestation, that fruit's not marketable, so the consumer won't see that bad quality fruit. What will happen is the grower will actually, if they let it get to that stage, they'll lose their crop. You know, whenever you have a major change like this, obviously people are going to get nervous, and, you know, fruit fly, like I mentioned earlier, is one of those crops that has the potential to really devastate a crop, whether it's berries or, you know, mangoes or any other, you know, most fruits are affected by it. So definitely growers will be nervous, but growers have to adapt to 100 challenges. Every season there's always something new, and growers know how to adapt, and this won't be any different.
That was New South Wales berry grower Emen Lel speaking to Laura Bohane. It is 18 minutes past 12. I'll bring you the latest on the Liberals' net zero decision up next.
This week on Landline, reviving a struggling country town through coffee.
I think the five of us are community-minded people, and I think you need that drive to do what we did.
That's Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So the Liberal Party has ditched net zero. Federal Opposition Leader Susan Lee says improving living standards for younger generations is central to her party's decision. Some Liberals have raised concerns, though, the new policy would make it hard to win over young and metropolitan voters. And representatives from the Liberal and National parties are going to begin talks today to settle a joint position on energy policy after yesterday's announcement. Ms. Lee says it's the federal government that actually should be worried, having broken its promise to reduce emissions and lower energy prices.
This Labor government is not delivering these things to Australian households, families and manufacturers. And we know that they are struggling with power bills that have gone up 40% since Labor came to power. So, James, 4 years of a Labor government, two elections where lower power prices were promised, and what we've seen is completely the opposite. And I know that going into summer, families, mums and dads are going to be worried about how they keep the kids cool in summer, whether they can afford to turn the air conditioning on. And meanwhile, we live in a country with energy abundance, and energy policy that is purely a train wreck under Labor.
I want to take you back to what actually happened yesterday, which was not about what the future of our energy mix is going to be. It was about the climate targets. And under the Paris Agreement, there's an aim to keep global average temperatures to well below 2 degrees and ideally below 1.5 compared to pre-industrial times. How many degrees of warming are you personally comfortable with?
We will remain signatories to Paris. It's an important international agreement. And that's right, James. It is about global temperatures. And it's 10 years old. And it's about nationally determined contributions being made, and we'll continue to make them and update them, just like other countries are doing, just like other countries are in some cases changing their NDCs, watering them down, being quite inconclusive about whether they can reach them, etc. Because we'll always put affordable energy for Australian households as a priority first. Whatever international agreements and what international tables we may be sitting down at. And I know that we do care about action on global warming and climate change. And that's something I believe in very firmly, and I know the next generations do as well. And that's why our policy for responsible emissions reduction is about reducing emissions on average year on year in line with comparable countries and as far and as fast as technology will allow. But that actually hasn't happened under this government,
sorry,
where
Cecily,
emissions
I'm gonna
are
jump
flatlining.
In there.
Meanwhile,
jump
prices
in there
are going
and just,
up.
And just take you back. So how can you stay in Paris if you're not then going to if you're going to then water down the targets? Because the idea is that targets are progressively improved over time.
Well, staying in Paris is about updating those NDCs, about sitting at the table with countries and acknowledging that we do want to play our part. But Australia will always act, or should always act, in our national interest. And I just did point you before, James, to what other countries are doing within the Paris Agreement. So it is possible to update those commitments and to still stay within the agreement.
Federal Opposition Leader Susan Lee speaking with James Glenday. Now, divisions within the Liberal Party over climate suggest this issue is far from resolved, even as the coalition is meeting today to decide a joint position on energy policy. So, will ditching net zero win the party votes? Dr. Jill Shepherd is a political scientist and survey researcher at the Australian National University, and she doesn't think so.
Look, I don't think it's going to shift any votes. Maybe it will shift some conservative voters to the Liberals, and maybe it will lose some progressive, moderate-leaning Liberal voters to the Teals or back to Labor. But I think in net terms, it's probably a wash electorally. What it will do, though, is allow the Liberal Party to coalesce under a slightly more right-wing position than Susan Lee would prefer, I think, as a moderate herself. But that's the nature of the Liberal Party at the moment. And it will also probably allow them to go into the next election in 2028, most likely, with a clearer framing around economic responsibility, keeping the cost of living down, all of the things that hurt them in May this year that they really are desperate to get back on top of going into the next election.
So there's no net zero target, but the Liberals are pledging to lower emissions year on year. Won't voters in city seats see that as an effective means of actually tackling climate change?
Well, look, the Liberals are trying to really speak out both sides of their mouth here, and I think a lot of voters who are worried about climate change will see through that and won't be convinced by this sort of avowed commitment to both lowering emissions but not net zero. I think a lot of those voters, though, have already left the Liberal Party. They have already parked their votes with Teal Independents or with the Labor Party, and so these aren't voters who were necessarily voting for the Liberal Party because of their climate change policy. If they were still with the Libs, it was in spite of their position on energy policy. So I don't think that really presents much of a problem for them. The bigger problem, I think, will be down the line if this position that they have at the moment to stay in Paris, but also not to keep lowering emissions targets, starts to unravel, because I think energy policy experts will tell you now that that's not necessarily even possible.
The coalition says its priority in all of this is to lower energy costs for Australians. How will they argue that stepping away from net zero will make power bills cheaper?
Look, I think they'll have to hope that voters don't look too hard into that. And luckily for them, voters are very busy and they're getting about their days. they don't necessarily know whether the domestic government can lower energy bills, but a commitment to try to do that, I think, will be taken well by a lot of voters. Not all voters, remember that, you know, there are some voters who will be voting on the basis of climate change action and then others who won't be. And so as long as they can keep pushing that message that even if this doesn't work, they're trying and that they understand, that may have an electoral win for them.
Do we know if voters pay attention at this stage of the electoral cycle, or is it more to do with how the parties prosecute the argument when it comes time to campaign?
Australian voters are barely paying attention at election time, let alone 2.5 years out. So I don't think there's any sense that voters are watching the news, you know, waiting with bated breath to know what the Liberals' position on net zero is going to be. The bigger problem for the Liberal Party is how this plays into a perception of competence, and competence is where elections are won in Australia. So if we go into 2028 and the Liberals have found themselves caught in knots trying to prosecute two cases simultaneously, one that they care about climate change, but also one that they are potentially opening new coal-fired power plants, that sense of competence becomes much harder to convince the voters of. So they may be creating a bit of a landmine for themselves by reaching this position now, but also they may find a way of being able to prosecute that case in a convincing way.
So the Liberal Party says it would remain in the Paris Agreement, but the leader, Susan Lee, says she wouldn't be afraid of copping criticism if Australia were to be in breach of that treaty. How do you think that apparent contradiction would be seen by voters?
I think the average Liberal voter is pretty happy to stick it to international organisations, whether that's the UN or whether that's COP and the Paris Agreement. Again, you know, if the Liberals are trying to win back teal voters and inner city voters, this absolutely isn't the way to do it. But if Susan Lee is trying to shore up her party room to find a compromise position that maintains her leadership and maybe allows her to win on the next issue, then I think she's probably done a decent job.
Dr. Jill Shepherd, political scientist and survey researcher at the Australian National University, speaking to Rachel Mealy. Now, if you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour today, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Away from federal politics now, and in parts of central and western Queensland, graziers and landowners are happily emptying their rain gauges this morning after some isolated and patchy storms dropped as much as 80 millimetres across parts of the region. So around Tambo Rumley measured 82 millimetres in their gauge, and nearby at Lansdowne, 30 millimetres was recorded. Other areas saw smaller falls in the single digits, but grazier Josh Phelps tells Madeline McCosker any rain is welcome this time of year.
So the few gauges we've got spread across the two properties at Tambo vary anywhere between 9 mil and around 40-odd mil. So, yeah, big difference. We'd had 20 millimetres in a storm last week. So where that rain's fallen on top of what we've had in the last 24 hours will be great. But, yeah, still certainly corners of the place that have, you know, very vast difference over the last week, you know, a difference of sort of 2 inches even. So I think the story is very similar in the broader district. Talking to neighbours this morning, you know, a couple of neighbours have tipped out 60 to 80 millimetres, but very isolated, as you could imagine. Certainly people just to the west of us have had next to nothing. So it's certainly that time of year, isn't it, where, the storms are patchy, but they're welcome.
Your place at Bohemia recorded 60 millimetres, so there is good rain around different parts of the state. I guess what does that kind of total mean at this point of the year?
Yeah, it was actually fairly dry in the general area, the Ralston-Bohemia area, driving to and from there. I think everyone was sort of starting to look heavenward. So, you know, absolutely welcome, obviously. Still showering there today. People are very optimistic, obviously, and eagerly awaiting to see what the next couple of days bring, seeing as though it's sort of the first day of 2 or 3 days of storms. And just this time of year, it's just such a godsend. You know, we can sort of ride ourselves into Christmas knowing that we're going to have something feed-wise. You know, what happens after that to finish a season, obviously need a lot more. But any rain this time of year is so welcome, especially, you know, back in the west there. We've actually become a little bit accustomed to these breaks before Christmas, which is a little bit uncommon, you know. So it's certainly welcome, and we're not going to wish it away. But obviously very, very patchy, and like I say, people just sort of eagerly awaiting the next sort of 48, 72 hours just to see if some holes will fill in.
Yes, so you just mentioned that people are sort of waiting to see how the weekend pans out. There are forecasts for rain and some storm activity over large parts of the state in the next few days. So I guess in those areas maybe where they haven't been getting these small showers recently, how hopeful do you think people are that the forecasts are going to come good over the next few days?
Yeah, well, as I've said to you before, Matty, you wouldn't do what we do if you weren't an optimist. So I think a lot of people are keen and hanging out. And look, it's not absolutely dire either. I do know of people that haven't had anything yet and south of us, and it's, you know, we'd all love a shower of rain, but we're going to get into Christmas in January easily enough, even on our place that sort of hasn't had a heap of rain. I think the feeling's very good generally. Obviously, the cattle market's reflecting what's going on with the weather, with these few changes coming through. People have sort of stopped mustering just for in the short term, at least, and are keen to just see what rain falls where before they go and make a decision to move many cattle again before Christmas. So that's driving prices upwards. If we can, you know, see that all rise, you know, 20 to 40 cents over the next week or two, and along with a green shoot coming, I think you'll have a lot of graziers with a smile on their face.
Tambo and Bohinia grazier Josh Phelps speaking with Madeline McCosker. Just looking at some of those rainfall totals around Tambo. So the Highlands north of Tambo received 56 millimetres. Lansdowne south of Tambo, 30 mils. Rumley south of Tambo, 82 mils. And then 9 millimetres at Ercildoune. Jinuma received 20 to 30 millimetres. 60 millimetres at Carramar. At Bohinia Downs. So also in central Queensland, Tendera received 112.4 millimetres. Mount Pleasant at Rolleston, 85 millimetres. Mount Larkham, 27. In the far north, 104 millimetres at Drumduff, and Fishhole Creek received 27 millimetres in the northwest. And I'll bring you more on where this rain will be falling in the next couple of days, because weather with the Bureau of Meteorology is up next.
ABC Breakfast. There's never been a better way to start your day. We're local like you, and we'll be right here every weekday when the sun rises. Join us for breakfast weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Shane Kennedy joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Shane.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So where will this rain fall in the next couple of days?
So I'm expecting a pretty broad area, so it should be most of the state should see something. It's probably just the Channel Country that has the highest chance of missing out, though parts of the northeast coast as well probably won't see a whole lot until Monday, when we have the bulk of the rainfall spreading across. So at the moment, we had a little bit of patchy rain in southeastern Queensland, but it's just starting to clear off now and turning more into showers and thunderstorms. And so we're starting to see those thunderstorms push into the Gulf Country and also in the southern interior at the moment. And it looks like one or two just around Taroom as well. And expecting that will continue to develop through the rest of today. And is to that watch point for severe thunderstorms once again today that could bring heavy rainfall, damaging wind gusts and large hail. That area today is east of about Quilpie and south of about Emerald, and will likely persist around, or extend a bit more into the southeast on the weekend before shifting focus to the far north.
Now, in regards to the large hail, is there any indication how likely that is to occur?
So it will depend on some of those more long-lived thunderstorms developing and then transitioning to that severe category, and should be not expecting any of those real high-end severe thunderstorms, so expecting it to be more around that 2-3 centimetre range is the current thinking, rather than that 5-plus that we had seen in previous weeks. So it's unlikely that they'd have quite the same sort of favourable environment or supportive environment to have those high-end severe thunderstorms. and expecting them to mostly be fairly isolated overall as well. But there is still that potential today, Megan, so it could see some 2 to 3 centimetre large hail. But again, most likely it'll be in parts of southern Queensland for the next couple of days.
Mm. And so, yeah, continuing on to be a wet weekend, is there any indication when things will start drying up?
So expect we'll make it a little bit of a pause on Saturday morning before the showers and thunderstorms really develop again Saturday afternoon. And then expecting those showers will develop into more of a broad rain band overnight Saturday and into Sunday. And that should extend across much of the state, apart from the far southwest. And then expecting that rain band should largely clear southern and central Queensland on Monday, particularly Monday morning, as we have some much drier air sweep in behind a trough system. But then that rainfall will likely get pushed across the northeast, including Townsville and the north tropical coast areas during that Monday period, before really contracting over Cape York Peninsula on the Tuesday. So likely, yeah, a little bit of a pause tomorrow morning, Megan, and then really ramp up late Saturday into Sunday before shifting into the north and far north on that Monday into Tuesday.
Hmm. Are there any places across the state that look like they're going to miss out on the rainfall?
So probably just the Channel Country. We'll only just see some more isolated showers and possibly a storm or two over the next couple of days. So expecting the bulk of the rain band will be a bit further north later into Saturday, particularly under Sunday at this stage. And also the northeast coast between around Cooktown down to Makita. Not likely to get too much over the weekend, but then we should have the remnants of that rain band moving across on that Monday. But again, it loses a bit of its strength by then, for rainfall more in that 10 to 25 millimetre range, so not likely to have too many negative impacts there.
Hmm. So I guess with this, you know, these rain and the storms, how is that impacting on sort of coastal waters?
So I expect things will get pretty grey over the next few days as well, but before then, generally have northwest and northeasterlies around that 15 knot range in the Gulf of Carpentaria. I should say pretty similar for the next couple of days. And for the eastern waters, we typically have northwest and northeasterlies as well, but a bit fresher there for the next few days, mostly in that 15 to 20 knot range, though a little bit calmer in the Cairns and Townsville waters. And shouldn't see too much of a change over the next couple of days there, Megan, though once this system moves out of the way and we get a clearing drier surge pushing across and in the wake of a trough, we'll likely have those winds pick up a bit with a bit of a south-southeasterly wind surge moving up the coast. So no strong wind warnings at this stage, but that may be a bit of a watch point early next week.
Hmm. So how will the rain impact temperatures?
So expect things will be pretty close to average for the next couple of days, but once that rain band really thickens up on the Sunday, they expect we'll have quite a plummet of those temperatures in the afternoon. Particularly in the northern and central interior and into the northwest around the Mount Isa region, where we could see those afternoon temperatures pushing up to 10 degrees below the average there. And so it'll mostly be around and just north of Longreach and then up into Mount Isa will be the biggest departure from average, but still be at least reasonably below average elsewhere across parts of eastern Queensland on that Sunday. And then even after those skies clear off on the Monday and into Tuesday, expecting we'll have some relatively cool southeasterly winds persisting in western Queensland. So much of the interior, so west of about Emerald, likely to be at least a few degrees below average for at least the first half of next week, and it may even be nudging up around that 6-7 degrees below the average as well. But certainly Sunday will be likely to be the coolest day with that wind chill factor and, yeah, that fairly steady and widespread rain.
And I noticed as well, there's still a number of high fire danger ratings across the state. Will these ease in coming days with the rain, or is there still some pockets of concern?
So I expect we'll still have some high fire danger persisting, mainly in the northern and northwestern interior over the next few days, but extending into parts of central Queensland, including the central highlands as well. And as you mentioned, should be enough rainfall around to really help to dampen those fires, fortunately, and get a bit of a lull on the Sunday just with those cooler temperatures. But then we're expecting some fresher winds and some drier air on the Monday, so we'll likely have a pretty broad area that nudges into the high fire danger ratings then. So, yes, certainly hoping that all the fuel will be still quite wet after the preceding several days of moderate rainfall, but Monday will be the next watch point for that increasing fire danger ratings.
Hmm. And looking into next week beyond Monday, what are the main watch points?
So things really settling down and into next week. So expect we'll still have some showers and thunderstorms persist over Cape York Peninsula, but should really ease off in the second half of next week. And elsewhere should be lots of dry conditions. We may have a bit of a weak trough start to develop inland on the Wednesday and then slowly drift west, but doesn't look like it will have a whole lot of moisture to play with, so not expecting much impact in terms of rainfall there. And then as we move closer to next weekend, we might have that moisture starting to increase again. So it'll be the next watch point for some thunderstorms, particularly in the southeastern interior next weekend.
Shane, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Megan. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Shane Kennedy, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
This summer, have a safe one by learning your ABCs. A is for action plan. B is for be safe. C is for connect. Find your local ABC radio station. Go to abc.net.au/emergency.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's been almost 8 months since the southwest experienced its worst flood in half a century. Residents in Ada Vale were evacuated by helicopter as their homes were destroyed. When they returned, the majority of the residents petitioned the Quilpie Shire Council to relocate the town to higher ground. Since then, there's been ongoing discussions, and recently a discussion paper was released outlining four options for the future of the town. The state government engaged public sector executive Andrew Chesterman to assist the council to better understand their options and the financial considerations of each, including repairing the township, making it safer, relocating, and a voluntary buyback scheme. Ada Vale resident Heidi Cowley spoke to Hannah Walsh.
So they come out just over a week ago and they spoke to each household one-on-one sort of thing, and they brought out a questionnaire about different options that could be potentials going forward for Ada Vale as a community. One of them was like repair. Another part was early warning systems, and then the third was about moving it. And I think it was more them trying to get a feel in writing as to what people's thoughts and feelings are down on paper, where we say where it's discussed and they have a black and white, not just what we've submitted to them, like previously we've submitted requests to move the town and things like that as a community. This was all done one-on-one. The paperwork that was sent out was all about possibilities. The people that they had come out and do the surveying and everything like that was what are the options for the people of Ada Vale. Part of that was early warning systems, putting in like a levee or something like that above the town. Discussion was on about moving town and costs involved as to what's covered, what's not covered, what grants could possibly be available and things like that.
So obviously you've always been on board and driving, wanting to move the town, but they've sort of come out in this draft paper and say that will rely on you being able to have the financial means to do so. Would you still hope you'd be able to get some sort of grants, or how do you think it would work?
Really would be appreciated if we could find some grants to help us do that. Or like, I don't know if there's some sort of either low interest or no interest. It's like a grant, but they lend us the money, we pay it back to help us do that, but having grants involved as well sort of thing, so a combination of things just so this doesn't have to happen again.
Ultimately, if relocating comes back to you being able to access the financial means to do so, or each resident that wants to move, what will you do?
Me and Steve see if we move up there, it's only potentials for growth in Ada Vale, whereas down here there's no potential for growth now. Nobody's willing to build or anything like that back down here. People that own blocks of land here don't want to build on them because you never know what's around the corner. So, for us moving up there, the town has the potential to grow. Like, if they want to add extra blocks, they could possibly add extra blocks. And it's on the main road to Quilpie and all of these sorts of things. So it has all these positives. And, like, yeah, there's obviously there'll be negatives in the background. Like, it won't be on
where Adava was born and bred sort of thing, but it still keeps the memories, the lifestyle, the history of Adavale has the potential to continue, whereas down here, as if there's no growth, then it will eventually die out to nothing.
But you need to work out what sort of grants or loans you'd be able to access before everyone makes a decision.
Yeah, exactly. Like, none of us out here are millionaires by any means. We live out here for the simple lifestyle that we get, the ability to own our own homes and things like that. So Steve and I is the perfect example. We live week to week with our bills and everything like that, and, like, we're comfortable, but there's definitely not extra money left over every week sort of thing. So
the Community Consultation Council have said is open until November 28th. Have they said anything about what will happen after that?
Not really. I think it's then they go back to their group and they discuss what's come out of the questionnaires and everything like that and what people would like to do. And then I guess they go forward from there as to what they can offer us and what they can help with. And, yeah, they haven't really explained what the next step is. A lot of them are still learning about how we go forward from here. None of them have ever been through this sort of situation before, so for them it's something totally different.
And what's the general feeling around town of people sort of just moving on? Are they frustrated with the process? Do they still want to move?
A bit of everything. Mm-hmm. Like, all of us are trying, like, we're 8 months on now, so a lot of us are trying to get going with life and not sit in that stalemate situation. All with the hope of, I think a lot of us still want to move up to higher ground just for that safety of not having to go through that again. But, yeah, it's like you look around town and there's no fences in a lot of places still, like the hall, men's camp, all of that sort of stuff is kind of at a hold still. Our tennis courts are still waiting on insurance to be sorted out so that we, like, tennis was something that we'd do on a weekend as a group of community members. We'd go up there, have a bit of a hit around with tennis, kids would play, and that's still all destroyed up there at the moment. So kind of a slow, everything's a slow process, and I think all of us just want to get back to some semblance of normality.
Adavale resident Heidi Cowley speaking to Hannah Walsh. Big decision for that town, how they're going to move forward after, you know, the Southwest experienced its worst flood in half a century. It is 12 minutes to one. Up next, a North Queensland community is celebrating an amazing milestone.
Are you a long-time listener or maybe a first-time caller? The ABC Listen app makes it easy to join the conversation. Download the app for free and use the call text buttons to get in touch with your favourite radio programs live. Download the ABC Listen app today.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Tully in North Queensland is marking a pretty big anniversary this week, finishing their centenary sugar crush, and it is all hands on deck right until the final moment. Sophie Johnson has this story.
The Tully sugar mill is just hours away from tipping in the last bin of sugarcane.
Yeah, so as we sit here now on Thursday morning, we've still got 21,500 tonnes to go. So we're doing about 14,500 tonnes per 24 hours. So it looks like we're going to be crushing out, you know, late Friday night, maybe early Saturday morning.
That's John Edwards, Chief Operating Officer at the mill. This year, the mill is expected to crush 2.16 million tonnes of sugarcane, which is down on the annual goal of around 2.5 million tonnes. However, spirits remain high with the extra excitement around this year's milestone.
Yeah, I guess we've been talking about the Tully Centenary and Tully 100 for, you know, a good number of years now. When the planning started, you know, probably 2.5 years ago now. So to we've, I guess, officially finished the last event for the centenary with our town event that we had Wednesday night last week. So to sort of wrap that up and to wrap the crushing season up in November of that centenary year, it's a great achievement from all.
In 100 years, a lot has changed at the mill.
Well, I guess from those early days when it was the mill was crushing 30 or 40,000 or 100,000 tons to the expansion through the district, through the mill, through everywhere to being able to process the 2.5, 2.6 million ton crop quite comfortably now. So in what 100 years is a long time, but it's not really. It's quite a short period of time.
The mill's cane productivity manager, Greg Shannon, agrees and says it's an honour to be part of the celebrations.
We stand on the shoulders of giants here. There's a lot of people done a lot of work over 100 years to... And I look back on those first 2 years, I look at the weather patterns. They were very wet years. I don't know how they crushed any cane at all. It was incredibly wet, and they not only built the mill and then got it going in very wet conditions. A lot of great people have been involved here over the years. The celebrations this year have been fantastic. The little barbecue we had the other night, it was great to be at.
Despite the cane volumes being low for the 100th crush, Mr. Shannon says quality has remained decent.
Well, the cane quality, in terms of things like fibre and soil, have been quite good, but the tonnes are down, obviously. We're about 10 tonnes down. We'll come in sort of high 74s, which is 10 tonne below our long-term average, slightly above last year. The really incredible thing about this year's crop is our CCS. It's basically flatlined, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Normally you'll start quite, you might start 11, go up to 13, 14, drop down to 9 or 10 at the end. Since we've been using ripener judiciously in the last 5 or 6 years, we've started probably 11 and a half and not quite dropped off as bad at the end. But this year, it's stayed in between sort of 12 and 13 all year. It's got up to a little bit higher than 13, and they're one of the reasons for that. And we're still pumping good sugar right now, which normally it's down, is with the dry. It's been very dry the last 6 weeks. We had a bit of rain last night, but we haven't had much rain at all in the last 5 or 6 weeks. And that's kept the cane quite dry and kept the sugar quite good. So it'll end up being similar to last year, but it's kind of flatlined all year.
Up the road from the mill is the local cane growers office, where manager Barry Dunn says it's not just the mill that's evolved over 100 years. Things have changed in the paddock too.
It is fantastic to be part of an industry that's had 100 years of achievement and really successfully as well. We've seen the industry grow from quite small beginnings and into one of the powerhouses of the sugar industry in Australia. Tully area was one of the last areas to be developed into cane, so originally it was quite small 100 years ago. But we grew quickly, and we're lucky that the mill invested in increasing capacity, because there was certainly demand from growers to grow more cane. And we still see that today. It's one of the things that's unusual about Tully. Our cane growers want to expand and grow more cane, and the limitation is really the capacity of the sugar mill.
As this year's crush wraps up, Mr. Edwards says attention is already turning to next year's crop.
We've had three really significantly wet years that have impacted on the growing and also impacted on the operation of the factory. The planting and the farming wasn't as interrupted as badly by the rain this year. So we've got the plant cane in at a good time during the year. I think the cane's looking better at this time of the year now than it was this time of year last year. So setting up for, there's a lot to happen between November and May 26th, but it's looking good.
The 2025 season has made its mark, and as the industry reflects on the past 100 years, Mr. Shannon says it's the people that's made it special.
When you talk about the mill, I talk about community. Yeah, it's not just a factory, it's a community, and it's the town's a great little community, which the sugar industry is such a massive part of. But yeah, it's been great to be part of it. I've only been here 12 years, but I'd like to hang around a bit longer.
Cane productivity manager at Tully Sugar, Greg Shannon, ending that report from Sophie Johnson. Did you know Australia has a cheddar queen? I'll introduce you to her up next.
You meet the most interesting people on Sunday morning.
I tell you what, I'd kill for some clean air and a good coffee over here. And there's no turmeric latte over here.
Come home straight away, please.
Join the rest of Australia right here on Sunday morning.
Australia Rollover on ABC Radio.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
In the heart of Gippsland dairy country in Victoria's east, one woman is known as the Queen of Cheddar. Ferial Zekimin trained as a pharmacist, but over the last three decades has made a name for herself as an award-winning cheesemaker. Faith Tabaluyan has this story.
Ferial Zekimin is used to the hum of hoses and milk vats.
So everything here is designed to make cheddar cheese, and the English territorials like Red Leicester, Sage, Derby, Cheshire.
For three decades, Ms. Zekimin has been producing handcrafted cheese from her Mafra factory in the heart of Gippsland dairy country. But her cheesemaking journey started in her grandma's Cypriot kitchen with a batch of homemade halloumi.
Well, halloumi is a rennetted curd cheese. So it was a matter of heating the milk to body temperature, adding the rennet, separating the curds from the whey, and then pressing the curd, and then storing it in a brine bucket, a strong brine bucket, because there was no refrigeration in Cyprus when my grandmother was making it. So that preserved the cheese throughout all seasons, basically.
Is that when you first realised that cheese was something that you were really passionate about, or...?
I don't think I was passionate about cheese as such, but the technology I was passionate about was very interesting. There's a huge range of cheeses and they're all different and they're all very challenging. Yeah, that's the bit I like.
In a previous life, Ms. Zekimin worked as a pharmacist, but she's now a master cheesemaker, most famous for her award-winning cheddar. Ms. Zekimin says it all starts with fresh milk from her herd of Tanamba dairy cows.
Well, I have a little transport truck, so the driver takes the milk from the farm at about 4:30 in the afternoon. He brings it back here and puts it into our refrigerated silos here, and then the next morning it's processed.
With a keen eye for detail, Ms. Zekimin soon transforms this milk into cheese.
We bring the milk in and it's pasteurised at 72 degrees for 16 seconds. And then it goes through a regen section where it's cooled down to vat temperature, 33 degrees. We add a fermenting culture, which ripens for an hour, developing acid from the lactose, lactic acid. We let the rennet set for 40 minutes and cut it into 1 centimetre cubes. So once it's cut, it's gently stirred for about 10 minutes and then the heat is applied to extract moisture from the curd. We monitor the acidity as the curd develops, and when we reach a pH of about 5.4, we mill the curd and add salt. And the salt slows the fermentation considerably. And so the parameters are 36% moisture in the cheese, a salt concentration of 2%, and an express of pH 5.4. So that preserves the cheese.
Back in the factory, Ms. Zekimin explains how acidity gives cheddar its distinct flavour.
Interestingly, with cheddar, when it first is made, the pH is about 5.4. As it matures, the pH rises because the amino acids are released, which are alkaline. So you end up with a pH of about 6 or 6.6 at about 6 months old. And that's when it develops that sweetness.
Right.
With a bit of a sharpness attached, you know, that balanced sweet sharp.
Today, Ms. Zekimin's cheeses travel all over Australia and the world.
We had an inquiry from overseas, Singapore, Malaysia, and our cheese had to be halal, and we were audited by halal auditors. So this product now goes on all the airlines, the Etihads, the Emiratis, the Qatars. So it's the halal certification that drives us, I think.
And Ms. Zekimin says her cheesemaking team is just as international.
I have several girls from Thailand, several people from Vietnam, the Philippines, and a lot of Aussies. And they're a great team. They get on well.
Seems like quite a family,
yeah,
actually.
It is.
And I guess you have to get used to having early mornings together. And
yep, they're all very loyal and committed.
And three decades on, Ms. Zekimin still has more grand cheese-related plans.
Oh, well, I have a grandson now who's developing a website and he's put more pressure on me. He wants some more specialty cheeses. So we're looking to develop a raclette and a triple cream brie and a Wensleydale blue. Yeah, so keeps me on the ball.
Ferial Zekerman, owner and head cheesemaker at Mafra Cheese Co., ending that story from Faith Tabaluyan. That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. News is up next. It's 1 o'clock.